Kirk, you were holding me accountable for something. I keep on referring to a fellow named Jerome, because if you look up who is the author of the Latin Vulgate, it always says Jerome. But his name wasn't Jerome, was it?
No.
And the reason we know his name wasn't Jerome is when was the letter J first invented and first used?
17th century CE.
Oh, my goodness. So we're off by a very long time. In fact, what the gentleman's name was actually, being nice by calling him a gentleman, he's a scumbag, saint scumbag, to Roman Catholics. It was Eusebius Sophronius. Eusebius Sophronius. Now, I don't know how you get Jerome out of Eusebius Sophronius.
How do you get Paul out of Shaul?
Paul changed his name. Paul deliberately changed his name from... But, you know, he admits that his name was Shaul, because when Satan was talking to him on the road to Damascus, he's Shaul, Shaul. So he admits that his name was Shaul, but Paul didn't want anything to do with Hebrew, because if you knew Hebrew, you knew that Paul was a liar. So Paul chose to side with Rome and took a Latin name, meaning lowly and little. Now, returning to Eusebius Sophronius, he says, if, on the other hand, we were to glean the truth by a comparison of many, and now he's talking about comparing texts which have almost nothing in common, why not go back to the original Greek?
Well, of course.
But there's a problem with that. Well, why don't we call him, instead of Eusebius, Erroneus?
Erroneus. Yeah, that's very good.
Okay, Erroneus. Was the Torah written in Greek?
No, sir.
Were the prophets written in Greek?
No, sir.
Were the Psalms written in Greek?
Not a one.
Did Yosha speak Greek?
No record of it.
No. So, it wasn't the original Greek, was it?
No.
So his plan to correct the flaws in Latin were to go to the original Greek, and yet the Greek wasn't the original.
We have a problem.
Houston, we have a problem. And he says, go back to the original Greek and correct the mistakes introduced by inaccurate translators. Well, okay.
Which one?
Which one? Which one are the inaccurate translators? The Greek is a translation, just as the Latin is a translation. So if you're admitting that the translators are inaccurate, well, you have a real problem. Now you've got two inaccurate translations. An inaccurate translation of Hebrew to Greek, and an inaccurate translation of Greek to Latin. So that's how they're going to correct the mistakes of the inaccurate translators and the blundering alterations. Now, this blundering alterations, that means it could be by accident, or alterations typically is purposeful, of confident but ignorant critics. And further, all that has been inserted or changed by copyists more asleep than awake. So we have blundering alterations. We have changes which have been inserted by comatose copiers. We have inaccurate translators. And you know something? We're not even out of the 5th century.
No.
This is, in fact, we're in the 4th century. This was written just shy of 400 CE. And already what you have is a swamp. You know, I use the term swamp to describe this. So we're going to get to that in just a moment. And I thought maybe I was a little harsh. And then I was going on and furthering this chapter, and I was translating the conditions that existed at the time of the flood that necessitated the flood in the region of Mesopotamia by Yahweh. And one of the more interesting words, it is Hamas.
Really?
And Hamas speaks of a swamp, a murky. He said the problem was that, you know, man turned the earth into a mucky and murky swamp. So maybe I wasn't so far off.
Yeah, thank you, guys. You nailed it.
Yeah, so here we go. So by the 4th century, these are the 300 CEs. Greek copies of the Christian New Testament were so divergent from one another, not only had they already become unreliable, the only way to fix the problem was to distill the vast array of errors into a single amalgamation of those many mistakes. This all obliterates the myth held by Christians that God would never allow his word to be corrupted. Sorry, but facts are facts. As a result, he either allowed it to be corrupted, or your God was impotent and could do nothing to stop it. As for the books that would have had merit, Matanya, Yaokanan, and Revelation. Now, by the way, was there a one of the disciples, did he have a name Matthew?
No, sir.
Did one of the disciples have the name John?
No.
No.
Hardly with a J.
No. So there you go. Another problem. But we can correct that. It was Matanya and Yaokanan.
Yes, we can. And I can write it.
All right. Now, unfortunately, those books which would have held merit have all been destroyed by translators and copyists. And a glaring example of this would be the story of the adulterous woman. You know, and it's you'll find it in John 8, 1 through 11. You know, the entire episode, the adulterous woman is brought to him, and he writes something in the sand. Nobody knows what it is, but the secret code is there in the sand. And then he says, let him without sin cast the first stone. What a resounding line. It's probably the most preached subject in Christian churches. John 8, 1 through 11, the whole story. Well, can you find that story? Can you find that story in the earliest copies of John from the early 2nd, 3rd, 4th century?
I don't think you can find it before about the 6th century.
No, that's too way too early.
The only reason I say that is because I have a Testacher, what's his name, that found the one down in Catherine's.
Oh, no, it's not in that. No, it's not in that. Okay. You're talking about the one in St. Catherine's Monastery. That is the Codex Sinaiticus. Yeah, no, it's not in that.
No, I thought it. Okay.
No, it's not in the Codex Sinaiticus. It's
academic to me if it's not in there in the first 400 or 500 years.
It's
got nothing.
Its first appearance. The first appearance is circa the 8th century.
Okay.
And by that time, he had thousands of manuscripts that doesn't exist. It was added because the Christians wanted their God man to contradict the Torah.
Yeah.
So that was added. But if you have something that significant added, what are you going to trust? You'd be a fool to trust it. You know, the entire episode is bogus. 8th century. There is no record of it in any of the many hundreds, if not thousands, of manuscripts composed between the 1st and 8th century. Not one. The entire episode was made up. Simply stated, this text of the Christian New Testament cannot be trusted. It has been in a constant state of degradation since it was first composed.
So the problem that... Why doesn't that register with people who write to you and tell you that your translations are off and they're King James, which is Shakespeare in English, another translation, 4 times removed or 100 times removed? Why doesn't that register with people? They just don't want it. They just don't care.
People of faith are allergic to evidence and reason.
Yeah.
Now, if you were to seek proof of this, read Philip Comfort's text of the earliest New Testament Greek manuscripts, where all 69 pre-Constantine manuscripts are presented for your consideration. Don't blame me for lack of faith until you have observed the evidence. In the introduction to his book, Comfort wrote, "This book provides transcriptions of 69 of the earliest New Testament manuscripts. All of the manuscripts are dated from the early 2nd century to the beginning of the 4th. A.D. 100 to 300. We chose the A.D. 300 as our terminus datum because New Testament manuscript production changed radically after the persecution under Diocletian in A.D. 303 to 305, and especially after Constantine declared Christianity to be a legal religion in the empire. Changed radically, my friend, when applied to manuscript production means that the manuscripts copied after 325 CE were so different than their predecessors, they were no longer comparable.
Wow.
Those are facts. You know, people think they're entitled to their opinions, but nobody is entitled to their own set of facts. Now, if you and I, or I, were to dive into a swamp and grab a bucketful of alligator excrement and dissect them, study them by amplifying them individually and collectively under a microscope, sharing every nuance that can be derived from a close and careful examination of said specimens, the fact remains that all we have is a bucketful of reptilian discharge that has been rotting away in a swamp. Nothing will ever change that. No matter how accurate or complete our rendition of the information conveyed therein becomes, it makes no difference how one slices them, analyzes them, polishes them, or rearranges them. Swamps not only tend to breed bacteria, they are home to some of the world's most venomous and deadly reptiles, and are not safe for human habitation. Such is the case with the manuscripts of the Greek text of the Christian New Testament. Any attempt to accurately translate what remains is akin to evaluating decomposing organic material plucked from a swamp.
Clean that one up.
As crude as this may sound, even shocking, it accurately depicts the conditions of the Christian New Testaments. And, oh, by the way,
mental picture there. God.
According to God, it's the reason for the flood. It is a central definition of Hamas, the term that Yahweh used to say that corruption and perversion had reached such an extent that man had essentially turned the region into a swamp, to a quagmire, to a grave where bodies would rot. Now, as it relates to the actual word of God, the Torah prophets and Mizmor, the Torah Nambi and Mizmor, to use the Hebrew words, the evidence is nearly as damning from one perspective, at least from the perspective of the Christian Bible and their translations. Between those who edited and created the Septuagint by translating the text from Hebrew to Greek, and those who copied their work, they were no more competent or inerrant. You know, as proof of this, by the dawn of the 3rd century CE, discrepancies between the many copies of the Greek Septuagint had become so pervasive, they required the better part of a lifetime to resolve. A resolution, however, that has been lost to time. 3rd century Christian scholar Origen devoted most of his life to overcoming these disparities. And he did the exact same thing that Jerome, erroneous now in our parlance, tried to do with the divergent Latin text that copyists and critics and others had made a mess of, turned into a swamp of excrement. But he tried to do it for the predecessor to the Latin text, which is the Greek Septuagint. And he created what was called the Hextapla of Greek translations. And he did it in Alexandria, which was the birthplace of the Septuagint. Now, in his commentary on what he called the Gospel of Matthew, he explained the purpose for creating this. This was his lifetime work. He says, due to the discrepancies. Now, this is going to sound a lot like our pal Erroneus, Jerome. Due to the discrepancies between the manuscripts of the Old Testament, we are able to overcome them using the testimony of other editions. Now, he's not talking about Hebrew. He's talking about Greek. This is because these points in the Septuagint, affirming that he's talking about Greek, which because of discrepancies, manuscripts aroused doubt. That's a powerful statement. So we reevaluated them on the basis of other editions. This is exactly what happened with the Quran. Now, the Quran, of course, is an 8th century document. But on the Quran, Muhammad admits that the Quran was harder to retain consistently than a runaway camel. And he would even talk about the variations of the Quran and whose variation that he preferred. And so there were, in written Arabic didn't even exist at the time that the Quran was allegedly revealed. And when they finally had written Arabic, it wasn't actually written Arabic, it was Hebrew. And so they tried to write it down, and of course they just came out with many different versions. So the Hadith, the oral reports from Muhammad and his companion, say that Abu Bakr, he's the fellow, upstanding citizen, he's the fellow that to endear himself with Muhammad, gave Muhammad his 6-year-old daughter as a sex toy. Yeah, when Muhammad was 50 years old, that's how upstanding he was. So this upstanding moral bastion of human dignity and character decided that because there were so many variations, there wouldn't be no way to have an authoritarian rule. And there's no way to say this is the word of God perfectly delivered from Allah through Muhammad unless all competing, all variations were eliminated. And that's what he did. He just simply disposed of all the variations. That's what Jerome did. There were so many variations of the Latin that, as he said, we can't pin our faith on the Latin text because there are too many variations. He just eliminated all the competition. He only had one left, and if he has one left and all the rest are destroyed, what do you got? Now that one, now that one's the authorized name. Word of God, and okay, yeah, and errant, yeah, exactly. And so that is exactly what now is happening with Origen and the Septuagint. We said there's so many variant copies, there's so many differences that the discrepancies are causing people to lose their faith, and the only way to resolve that is to end up with one, to homogenize them together and come up with one variation, one version out of the many flawed versions. So his assessment of the Septuagint was therefore identical to Arrhenius's evaluation of the Latin text. Discrepancies abound. His solution was also the same. Compare texts filled with disagreements and choose which variations to accept and discard. Now, I can get into his some detail here, but I just did summary form. The reason it was called a hextapla, what he did is he pulled together four blended translations that he was able to find in various parts of Egypt. And then he had a copy of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms transliterated into Greek, and then another copy actually written in the Hebrew text. But there's no indication that he was a Hebrew scholar or even a Hebrew student of Hebrew. But anyway, he had all of those there, and he then attempted to justify a resolved text. But the problem is that his little project, well, it turned into a project that was so large, it's 6,000 pages long. Now, 6,000 pages long back in the day when you didn't have a printing press, handwritten, and only one copy, 15 volumes, 6,000 pages long. However, let's just say that he created some manner of resolution to fix this problem through those 6,000 pages, lost a time. He was poorly regarded, seldom considered. He was defrocked. He was banished from Alexandria by Bishop Demetrius. He fled to Israel, or he was tortured by Emperor Decius. Pardon?
Why do you think he went there?
Well, you know, you're in Alexandria.
Yeah.
You have the bishop of Egypt that is trying to kill you. You know, what's the closest place you can go that's outside of his control?
Yeah, and you would have thought he would just kept going, though, rather than...
The closer he got to, for example, Constantinople,
mm-hmm.
the worse it would have been, been for him.
Yeah.
In fact, it was a Roman emperor that killed him.
Killed him, yeah.
So upon his death, the lone copy of his hextapla was hidden away in the library of the bishops of Caesarea. collecting dust for centuries. It was then destroyed during the Muslim invasion in 638 CE. So all we know is that, and you know, it's not that he didn't provide a service. While his book did us no good whatsoever.
Service to whom? Yeah,
it's the fact that he did declare that after a lifetime of work in 6,000 pages, that the Septuagint by that time was untrustworthy. It was way too corrupt. That, again, should send shivers down the spine of anyone who is a Christian.
Now, is there a theologian anywhere that would not have read this, had to read this in their school?
I don't know. I don't know if they, you know, who's going to stay? Who's going to continue in Bible school?
If they were. Sorry.
Yeah.
Point taken.
Now, there was a lone potential beneficiary. Was the book that the manuscript that you mentioned, the Codex Sinaiticus,
mm-hmm.
But it was deliberately hidden in St. Catherine's Monastery, and that was Constantine's mama, and the Sinai Peninsula.
Right.
It was not discovered until the 19th century when its contents were quickly dismembered and scattered around the world. It wasn't until the late 20th century that the Codex was made available to textual critics. Which is to say, apart from proving that the Septuagint was unreliable, the Hextapala project was a complete waste of time. So now that we know that the Latin Vulgate was nothing more than a compilation of errors of earlier translators and copyists that they had made based upon the Septuagint, and that the early Greek manuscripts were similarly flawed, let's complete the story. How did the errors and divergent renderings found in the Greek Septuagint and Latin Vulgate find their way into the earliest English translations? With so many variants, why are English translations, the earliest ones, all exactly the same?
Well, they have to copy the Jerome's.
You betcha. Huh? The first to compose and distribute an English translation was a fellow named John Wycliffe, producing them by hand around 1380 CE. To his credit, he did so because by reading the Latin Vulgate, he recognized that the teachings and claims of the Roman Catholic Church were wholly inconsistent with the text of the book they claimed had authorized them to be the exclusive representatives of God on earth. Now, Roman Catholics today have no excuse. It takes 15 minutes to recognize that the claims of the Roman Catholic Church are in direct conflict with the Word of God. But, you know, it took a man of courage back then to say this and to deal with it, to expose it. His resulting translation, however, wasn't based on a Hebrew or Greek text, but instead was derived from an amalgamation of errors known as the Latin Vulgate, only because there were no Hebrew or Greek texts available to him. Wycliffe and his associates produced 12 copies. Most were burned by the Roman Catholic Church on orders of the Pope. He was so infuriated with Wycliffe for translating the Latin Vulgate into a language ordinary people could actually read for themselves. Wycliffe was banished as a heretic, and 44 years after his death, the Pope had his bones dug up, crushed, burned, and then scattered.
Yeah.
Even worse, John Huss, one of Wycliffe's associates, for the crime of opposing the tyranny of the Roman Catholic Church, was burned alive by the church in 1415. Not only was that the prescribed penalty of the Roman Catholic Church for anyone possessing a non-Latin Bible, the Pope used Wycliffe's translations to kindle the fire, to burn a man alive, who simply wanted people to know the truth. If you were among the 1.2 billion who called themselves a Roman Catholic, you should be ashamed of yourself. You know, today the pooper, the Pope. He was over there in I think Auschwitz, one of the concentration camps. I think it was Auschwitz. And you know what his big statement was when he was in Auschwitz? He asked God to forgive him the horror that took place there.
Yeah.
Now, do you think that God is going to forgive those who massacred 12 million people, 6 million Jews, but 12 million people total in those concentration camps. Not only murdered 12 million Jews, 2 million of them were children under the age of 2.
Yeah.
Do you think that God is going to forgive them so that we'll get to see them in heaven?
Terry and I had this same conversation earlier today. It's absolutely not. How disgusting.
It is for him, first of all, for him to think that God listens to him, that he can influence God, is preposterous. But to think that God would forgive people like this so that their sins would be wiped away and that they would come through the door of heaven and we would spend our eternity with those scumbags? I mean, think of the level of depravity that you'd kill 2 million children under the age of 2 and 12 million people in concentration camps, bringing them there for the purpose of max execution, and that you would ask God to forgive them? Oh.
It's unbelievable.
In 1490, Oxford professor and physician Thomas Linacre, after reading the biographical accounts in the Greek New Testament, and then comparing them to what he had read in the Latin Vulgate, concluded that they were so different that they could not have come from the same source. He was right. Then in 1516, the precursor to the intellectual fraud and financial hoax known as the Texas Receptus was perpetrated on an unwary public by Desiderius Aramis, Rotterdamus. He was a living contradiction. He was a celebrated Dutch humanist, a homosexual who was known to have affairs with his colleagues and students, a Catholic priest, way ahead of his time, devoted to the Pope, a critic of the Catholic Church, and a Latin scholar, as well as a Protestant protagonist.
That's a lot on your plate, ain't it?
That's a lot on your plate. The moment he mastered Latin to his satisfaction, he attempted to replicate Jerome's work. And in 1512, he collected every Latin manuscript he could find to create his own edition by consolidating the divergent texts. Of this, he wrote, "It is only fair that Paul should address the Romans in somewhat better Latin." That was his motivation. "It's only fair that Paul should address the Romans in somewhat better Latin." Oh, man, he could not contain his enthusiasm or ego, writing, "My mind is so excited at the thought of amending Jerome's text with notes that I seem to myself inspired by some God."
Guess which one?
"I seem to myself inspired by some God, indeed." No one paid much. Now, by the way, you know, with Jerome, you just can't wipe him off and say, "Oh, well, so that was just Jerome." That was the basis of your English Bibles.
Yes.
That was the only Christian Bible for over 1,000 years. And now if you want to poke holes in Erasmus, good luck with that. Because guess what Erasmus provided? The Texas Receptus. It's the only text that can claim to have played any role other than the Latin Vulgate in your Christian translations. And we're going to learn a lot about this man, both on this program and again tonight on Yada Yada Radio. Now, no one paid much attention to Erasmus's Vulgate changes, his own version. So he sought fame by beating the Roman Catholics to their Compulsanium Polyglot to print. That was the Roman Catholics decided after 1,000 years that they were going to produce a Christian New Testament in Greek. And old Erasmus said, "Boy, if we can beat them to print, We'll have a bestseller on our hands. More this evening.